Hi, you're tuned to Truth News Radio Australia, and it's the 4th of March, 2012. I'm your host, Hereward Fenton. Welcome to another show, and I'd just like to welcome listeners to this show in the United States. We've started broadcasting now on Logos Radio Network, which runs out of Austin, Texas, and is covered on about 27 other FM radio stations, so I've been told, around the US. So our listenership has just expanded dramatically, which is really fantastic. It's really important for us to have that. And I really hope that I'm able to bring some information to our listeners in the US, which is a little bit different. And of course, we get into a lot of discussion on perspectives of international importance, and today is certainly no exception. So I really look forward to hearing any feedback from our listeners on the other side of the Pacific. And in today's show, I've got a really big show lined up, actually. I've got, first of all, John Bursell on the line with us to discuss a new initiative that he has launched in terms of a popular activist movement against the intervention in Iran, and particularly to deal with the very, very threatening behavior from Western countries in terms of Iran, and talking about a military strike, which of course has been going on for years. But John has decided to take the bull by the horns and actually organize a protest and try and get people motivated. Now, in the second half of the show, I've actually got, first of all, I've got Josh Jackson coming on to discuss issues about privacy in Google. And we're really going to get into looking at the new Google privacy statement that they've released, which they've actually announced that they've changed their privacy settings. We're going to look at the current privacy settings in Google, and we're going to look at the previous arrangement that Google had and compare that. And we're going to look at the whole question of privacy on the internet. And this is a really interesting subject because it raises a lot of questions which are a little bit unexpected sometimes when you start to get into it in more depth. Then in the second hour of the show, I should point out to our Australian listeners, we now have a two-hour show. So in the second hour of our show, I'm actually going to be interviewing several people who've responded on Facebook to an article which was written by some Australian academics and published in the British Medical Journal. Now, the article effectively it looks at medical ethics, but it looks at the issue of abortion, and it takes some logical arguments to their logical extreme about, for example, the medical ethics of abortion. And it says that basically runs the line that if it's ethically okay to terminate a fetus, then it is equally okay to kill a newborn baby if you can argue that that child will not be taken care of, will not be wanted, will not have the benefits of a loving environment, better to just kill the baby. Quite an extraordinary, shocking story. And of course, it was on the front page of the Sydney Morning Herald, which is one of the major newspapers in the country. It's one of the two top newspapers in Australia. This was on the front page of the newspaper. Killing newborns has been proposed as a new approach in medical ethics. So we're going to get into that with some discussions from people, from listeners to the show and parents, and really, really analyze that and try and understand what is driving it. Now, without further ado, I'd like to bring John into the discussion. John Bursell, are you there?
G'day, Hereward. It's good to be on the show, and I'm so glad that you now got the bigger audience you've talked about throughout the US.
Yeah, look, and of course, John, you've got a lot of contacts over there, so hopefully some of the people you know will be picking up this show. And we really do look forward to kind of, I guess, building a better network, because we really have to make a global connection with a lot of the things that we're talking about. And of course, the issues that you're bringing today are a classic example of that.
They are. Well, they're also an example of what sort of happened to the 9/11 truth movement. Obviously, I was involved with that with you for many, many years, since 2006. We've gained and learnt so much about geopolitics and the world situation. We really now have some sort of, you know, duty to move forward with this information and carry on the fight. And this imminent Iran war is something that's really drawn my attention, and it's made me decide that I should use the knowledge that I've garnished from looking at false flag terrorism, from looking at geopolitics, from looking at PNAC and groups like that, and understanding what they're about and what the US empire is about at the moment, and trying to use that knowledge to move forward to keep this truth awareness flowing.
Absolutely. And I didn't actually introduce you properly for those who do not know you. Most of our listeners on this show do, but we have a much wider audience now. So I just point out, John, you are a long-time member of the 9/11 Truth movement, and of course you're an engineer and a member of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and you organized a lot of really important protests going back to 2007 and some conferences here in Sydney, which were actually quite successful. And you've recently sort of pulled back from talking about 9/11, but you've decided that to focus on the issue of war with Iran is now something that I guess that network of people that we've built up should perhaps be really looking at as a motivator in, again, to bring us all back together.
Well, exactly. And I mean, I've developed the skills, just as you have, to to put together an argument and rationale looking at what we see. And a lot of people around us, even though we don't realize it, I know this happens on Facebook, I literally have hundreds of people read articles and things I put on Facebook that never like or make any comment, but they're watching, you know. So we've sort of, like I was saying, we've sort of got a duty. Some people are looking, you know, to us as the people that were calling out 9/11 back in 2006. Most of the population are aware that 9/11 was not as it is, but they don't really want to get into the nitty-gritty, or they don't really want to, see this world in such a dire state. But when they look at Iran, say, for instance, with this issue, they can see how insane the idea of going into Iran is. And to me, it's a very similar issue to 9/11, because we're exposing the lies that lead to war. And obviously, the only reason that the American population and the world population got behind, you know, killing brown people in foreign lands to steal their resources was because of 9/11.
Absolutely. Now, we've done, our most recent show was on the Iran situation, and we were looking at the currency issues and, of course, the oil question, with Iran intending to trade oil off the US currency, and the date for that being set at March 20, I believe. I mean, do you believe that that date has something to do with the sudden urgency with which we're having these calls for the military strike to go ahead?
Well, there's no other way to see it, in my view. And obviously, the oil burst, as such, they call it, is basically in existence, and it's been trading in different ways, but it's on March 20th that it drops the US dollar completely. And obviously, in my view, I'm not sure what your view of this is, Harrowood, but if the US dollar is dropped by Iran, who trades about 22% of China's oil and trades with many other people around the world, that can have an effect on the value of the American dollar, and definitely on the American power, you know, with the US dollar, because obviously the American country as such now doesn't produce much. Mostly they trade, or they control trade, or they control, you know, the banking systems, for example. That's how they make most of their revenue. So if we take away the value of the US dollar by not trading oil in it, then it's very, I make the argument in my paper or my article there, that it could lead to a situation where the American empire could start to fall apart. And maybe that's why we see so much rhetoric around this war with Iran.
Yeah, look, I totally agree. I think that American power has always been largely based on its ability to control currency by essentially having the American dollar as the default international currency. And that arrangement was made possible, I guess, because America was the dominant power that won the Second World War. And even though the Soviet Union obviously played a huge part in that, the US had more global influence to be able to create the global economy as we now know it. Of course, then the Soviet Empire somewhat collapsed. The Soviets did actually have a large block of their own, which they probably dominated in a similar way, and I'm not totally expert in that area. But certainly since the collapse of the Soviet Union, the United States and the US currency really has been the dominant power on Earth, and that could well be undermined. And I also believe that this could also be an intentional strategy on the part of the Iranians, and it may have been a deliberate strategy on the part of Saddam Hussein and also on the part of Gaddafi, who obviously have paid the ultimate price for what they tried to do. But I don't know if you remember going back to the first Gulf War, John. I keep hearing these words in my head, the famous words uttered by Saddam Hussein, who said, "The mother of all wars has begun." And, when I see these new wars now looming, I think back to Saddam Hussein's statement in 1991.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, I'm thinking more about what Putin just said. And, there's an article up on the ABC that you can find and plenty of other places around the world that talk about what Putin's been saying. Putin's been saying that there's going to be catastrophic consequences to this intervention if America goes into Iran. He's saying that it's impossible to imagine the real scale of the war. Now, this is really why I got active. I read an article by Paul Craig Roberts. I read many articles by Michelle Chosadowski out of globalresearch.ca. I've read quite a few other articles in the mainstream media like the Sydney Morning Herald and others that, a little bit tamer, of course. But basically, many people out there are actually starting to really talk about how dangerous this could be. Obviously, if America attacks Iran, it's a completely different scenario, in my view, to Iraq, not because of the scale of the country, but because of the scale of its allies. Iran is very well supported. It's really more of a European country than it is an Arabic country. And, it's basically, it's one straw too far, and basically I think that we're looking at a World War III scenario. Would you agree with that?
I think it's highly, I won't say likely, because I don't really want to encourage people to think this is going to happen, because I think it can be stopped. But according to the current trend, according to where we're currently steering the ship, the ship's going to hit this iceberg. But if you were able to turn the ship away, we could avert the iceberg. But there will come a point where it's too late, that even if we try to turn, like the Titanic, you turn too late and you still hit the iceberg. And I think we're getting very close to that point. Now, the article you referred to was on the ABC website, "Putin Warns Against Catastrophic Attack on Iran." Prime Minister Vladimir Putin says Russia is concerned about the growing threat of an attack on Iran, warning that the consequences will be truly catastrophic. In an article on foreign policy to be published later today, this was last week, 6 days before a March 4 presidential election, which is actually happening right as we speak, Mr. Putin has also warned Western and Arab nations against military intervention in Syria. Now, we've just got a break coming up, John, but I'd like to, in the next segment, we've only got you for one more segment, I'd like to actually combine the discussion about Iran with looking at what's happening in Syria, because obviously these two are very closely connected. So we'll be right back after the break. Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now. Welcome back to Truth News Radio Australia. My name's Herowood Fenton, and I am today talking to aircraft engineer and long-term member of the 9/11 Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth and a passionate anti-war activist, John Bursell. And we are talking about Iran and we're talking about Syria and what we can do to, as a citizens' movement, to have some effect on our government. Now, John, just getting back to where we were before, I'll hand it to you, but I'd like to consider, as I was saying before, the question of Syria also.
Well, obviously, Syria is a long time ally of Iran, and it basically is very important, I suppose, in the strategy that the neocons have of surrounding Iran. And if Syria falls, then really the game's on with Iran. So I think if Syria happens, we're going to see more happen to Iran. Now, at the moment, obviously, you can make the argument that Iran's already in war with the US because of the sanctions and other things that are happening. They're killing their scientists. They're blowing things up within their country. Bush, I'm pretty sure it was way back, maybe 2004, Bush was basically coming out saying that there was a covert CIA operation like what they did to Mossadegh to destabilize the Iranian government. So really, the war's been on for quite a long time. I think the point I was just about to make before we went to the break was that, you know, we're in a situation where we could have a nuclear conflict, limited or larger scale, but also that we could go back into a Cold War situation. So we could have another world war, but it might be more of an economic type style war, or we could be in a situation where they decide to finally duke it out. We know that these crazies that came out of the Reagan era, the neocons, Cheney, you know, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, all these people from the Project for the New American Century, actually believed that they could fight a nuclear war and win. And they still believe it today. So these people are prepared to go all the way to have complete world dominance. And I'm not sure if many people are aware of that. And that's really why I'm interested in this rally that we're putting on the 24th of March at the Sydney Town Hall.
Absolutely. And the details there, it's on Facebook. There's a Facebook event, Say No to a War with Iran, Deflate the War Hype with Truth Awareness, Saturday, March 24th, 2012, 11 a.m. Anyone who's in Australia, I do encourage you to try and get here for that. If you're in Sydney, you must come. It's really important. Now, of course, when I say you must come, I just mean, look, I really would like you to come, and it will make a difference. A lot of people out there have been very concerned about what's going on. And sadly, there has been very little organized, and we have a anti-war movement in Australia called the Stop the War Coalition. Now, that same name has been used for some groups in the UK, I believe, and I believe they are connected, the Stop the War Coalition in the UK and the one here.
And there's some great people in those groups, and some of those people have come to events about 9/11.
Okay, and that's very important. Yeah. That's very important. And
but they've never embraced the concept of having to, you know, question the events that lead to the wars. You know, the peace movement's always been about reacting to the death and destruction of war. And really, you know, this idea of trying to bring, you know, the remnants of the 9/11 truth movement, the larger truth movement, you know, and some of the peace movement, if they're interested or whatever happens, the union movement, which, you know, to some degree is involved with some of the campaigns we've been involved in, coming to an issue that we can find absolute complete unity on. No one wants a war with Iran except for the very, very powerful elite inside the US and inside Israel that see this as a watershed moment in history where they're going to change the world. They're going to, yeah, sure, it's going to be painful, but they're going to come out on top, and it's going to be, you know, this new world order that, you know, Bush Sr. imagined.
That's right. Look, I can't add to that, John. It's just that you've said it so well. So what I'm a little bit surprised about is that there hasn't been anything from the Stop the War Coalition, which is an organization specifically set up to do this kind of thing. But, and I do know that you're going to reach out. So you hopefully will get onto their networks and bring more people into it that way.
I will attempt to. There has been a lot of resistance. I remember I probably made a mistake. A lot of us in the 9/11 Truth Movement got extremely frustrated with the peace groups. And I can remember a rally in particular where about the Afghanistan war that we attended. You know, it was about 30 of us and we went along. And I was sort of told that I'd be able to get a chance to speak about our upcoming Architects and Engineers event. You know, and I've always stuck to the very good evidence with 9/11. I don't really think you could call me a conspiracy theorist. I've tried to stay away from that and be very factual in the evidence that I've presented. But anyway, like they sort of said that we could speak at the end of this rally, and you know, some of our activists become rather, you know, upset that we didn't get any sort of mention. There was no mention of 9/11, and basically, you know, in the end, we sort of started, I suppose, crashing their party. And you know, after it finished, you know, we made some announcements on our loud howlers, and we were very upset that we didn't even get a chance to speak, because to us, questioning the pretext to war with so much evidence was, you know, so obviously a good thing for the peace movement, but they simply couldn't embrace the idea of how terrible their own governments can be. And we've really got to get beyond that now. We've got to realise that wars are created by these false flag events. You know, they're manipulated. They're about, you know, the redistribution of wealth from the poor to the rich. You know, simple concepts like this are so difficult sometimes for good, peaceful people to really understand, you know. And it's a terrible shame, but let's hope that we can get some unity and we can get over our differences and start working together.
Yeah, look, and I should just point out that the possibility of a false flag event triggering a military engagement in the Straits of Hormuz is extremely high. And really, there's no reason to doubt that. If you look at the history of military, the history of conflict, it would only take a small skirmish to basically then become the pretext for a larger war. And I also think it's quite significant in relation to 9/11 that the president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, is, I believe, the only head of state currently sitting who has actually gone on the record to say that the official story of 9/11 is wrong, and that he said that, you know, to the UN, and he's actually said it more than once, and basically he's put forward the view that it was either an inside job or that there may have been other nations involved. Of course, the Iranians have a very strong anti-Israel sentiment, and that, of course, doesn't help getting people on side here when the president of that country says that Israel might have been connected to 9/11, which I believe he did say. But the point here is that...
And there's no clear evidence of that. Let's get that straight. But, yeah, you know, obviously Israel loved the idea of 9/11 because it gave them the massive US presence in the Middle East. But we do have clear evidence that Saudi Arabia were involved, and Saudi Arabia have just received $60 billion worth of new armaments from the US. $60 billion. I believe it's the largest trade in weapons in the history of the world. That only just happened recently. So we see, you know, and we see Israel with American troops now there. We see Kuwait with a troop build-up. We see an aircraft carrier being converted into a marine base. We see, you know, two aircraft carriers in the Gulf ready to go, a full battle group ready to go. You know, the situation is very obvious, you know, that we're in this situation that a lot of the American allies obviously had to know and be involved in these lead-up events. Cheney called for a false flag attack against a ship in the Gulf to facilitate a war with Iran. He's been wanting a war with Iran forever, you know, since basically they took control once again of their oil supply.
Absolutely. Now, John, you've also written an article which is currently on truthnews.com.au, Deflating the Hype. And that's just a note there for our listeners, well worth having a read. And you can leave some comments on there. And you've put some links in, quite a few links to important, relevant articles.
Well, it's called Deflating the Hype. Can the seemingly imminent war with Iran be stopped? And I just make the argument that there's two sides of the story. You know, there's the situation and then there's the war propaganda. And they're very easily distinguished. And you do that by looking at the evidence. There's no evidence that Iran's creating a nuclear weapon. There's plenty of evidence that there's a propaganda campaign within the US and its allies throughout the world to make it appear as if Ahmadinejad is crazy. He wants to blow up Israel. He wants a nuclear weapon. All these things. They're dealing in drugs. They're dealing in guns. I provide links to all these types of sources so someone can actually go through this article, watch some YouTubes, read some articles, and get the history to see how powerful this media hype is. And a lot of it is backed by Israel. So, you know, that's why I mentioned Israel quite a few times in the argument, is because they're speaking out. You know, they're taking it to the Iranians. You know, they're making very obvious they want to take out Iran.
Great. Now, John, I'm looking forward to this event. I'll be there. We'll have our equipment
Harry
there.
Will be speaking.
Yeah, I'll be speaking, so I'll have to think of something appropriate to say. We'll have to wind it up. Thank you very much, John, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Harwood.
I've got a song here for you. This is Tom Petty with Square One.
Had to find some higher ground. Some fear to get around. You can say what you don't know. Later on won't work no more. Last time through I hit my tracks. So well I could not get back. Yeah, my way was hard to find. Can't sell your soul for peace of mind. Square one, my slate is clear. Rest your head on me, my dear. It took a world of trouble, took a world of tears. It took a long time to get back here. Try so hard to stand alone. Struggle to see past my nose. Always had more dogs than bones. I could never wear those clothes. It's a dark victory. You won and you also lost. Told us you satisfied, but it never came across. Square one, my slate is clear. Rest your head on me, my dear. It took a world of trouble, took a world of tears, took a long time to get back here.
Welcome back to Truth News Radio Australia. Well, ladies and gentlemen, Truth News is expanding. As I mentioned earlier, we're now being carried across the US, mainly Austin and Oklahoma, but a number of other stations across the US are carrying us, and we'll soon be moving to a live format. This broadcast will actually be on the networks on this coming Thursday, but it won't be live. Probably the future broadcast will actually be a live broadcast and we'll be able to take phone calls. Josh, welcome back, and just introducing you to our new audience, Josh Jackson.
G'day, folks out there in Cyberland and Radioland. Welcome to Truth News Radio Australia, the voice of Australian truth, coming right at you.
Great, that sounds like a promo. We should capture that.
Yeah. Oh, it's very exciting. It's very exciting to finally, you know, talk to people from all around the world. I mean, we've always been global because we've been a podcast in the past, and we're going to continue being a podcast. But yeah, it's fantastic to be able to chat to our American friends. Absolutely.
Absolutely. And we are going to, in this section of the show, look at something which is equally important to virtually everyone on the globe, because we're looking at Google and we're looking at privacy. And of course, Google has recently announced changes to its privacy policy. And some people have been alarmed at those changes, but of course, Google has always been quite open that it does actually suck in most of your information. But there are some changes now that are in terms of the way it uses all that information. Now, Josh, you're a very techno-savvy kind of guy. I mean, you work on the bleeding edge of technology. You're a high-end 3D developer. And, of course, you know, an avid Facebook user and an avid Google Gmail user and a Google Plus member. And I'd like to just get your overview of Google's sort of history and its current changes to the privacy policy, and then I want to really kind of analyze it and deconstruct it.
Yeah, I mean, I love the Google products. I think they're absolutely fantastic. They're very good for a free product. There is definitely competition around the place for everything that they offer, but they do it so well, and they do it for free, so that's pretty hard to beat. But as they say, if something's free, then you're usually the product. So, you know, in one way, their privacy policies, I find they don't scare me as much as other people, because Google don't have armies and prisons and guns pointed at me. You know, what does worry me is if governments can get hold of the information that Google will collect and collate.
I understand. Can you actually outline what the privacy policies were and currently are? What are the changes, and what is the previous state of affairs?
Okay, so but previously, every Google product, and there's literally, you know, hundreds of them. So there's Google Docs for documents. It's like a Word alternative, but it's online. There's Gmail, of course. There's YouTube, which everybody knows, and there's Web, which is their mainstay, which is web search. So and you know, the list goes on and on. There's music now, and Google Wallet, and all these other products. Now, every one of them in the past have had their own privacy policy. So when you signed up to them, you signed up to its own privacy policy, which was its own little storage point for you, for all the information it would collate on you. So say you're on YouTube, you're looking around on videos, it would collect data on your profile to basically serve you up other videos. So if you looked up a lot of videos on I don't know, the Iran conflict or sports games or whatever, on the side you'll say, hey, here are other videos that might interest you, or here's some you know what I mean? So it would slowly,
absolutely,
it would, but also try to target advertising. I mean, the main reason is that they want to get the right sort of ads in front of you that you might click on. So if you're interested in bicycles, then it'll bring up bicycle ads. So if you're searching a lot of YouTube videos. Now, what's happened is if Nowadays, what's going to happen after the 1st of March, which has just passed, all of the privacy policies are getting wound into one. So if you sign up to Google with a Google login, you're basically allowing Google to say, hey, whatever you check on YouTube, Google Search, Google Docs, Gmail, it all goes into one thing, and it's one suppository of your profile. Now,
repository. hopefully it's not the other word. But anyway, sorry.
Yeah. So
I mean, that might have been just a glitch.
So the thing is that, you know, for me, a lot of people are saying, "Oh, this is terrible," but at the same time, you know, they have to try and get the right sort of ads. This is their business model, and they've always been upfront with the fact that, hey, we, you know, when you sign up to Gmail at the start, Gmail, you know, every other mail client offered you, you know, 60 meg or something like that. And then Gmail came along and said, hey, we offer you 6 gig, but, you know, we crawl your emails and deliver you ads that we think might be relevant to the emails you're reading. And some people were like, I'm not going to do that. And that's fine, you know, you've got a choice. And some people went, oh, well, I don't mind.
Yeah.
Now, you know, this is the security issues that people are coming up upon now, is that all that information is coming from YouTube, from Gmail, all these different places into one place.
Now, if I can just interject for one moment, my understanding also is that the Google search engine will, when you do a search in Google, right, we tend to think that the search is has a standard based on some kind of global search engine, right? However, my understanding of it, tell me this if I'm wrong, but the Google search engine is actually going to deliver search engine results customized to you based on your profile. I mean, currently we know that if you select, for example, pages from Australia, you'll get pages from Australia. But that's one type of filtering that it's done. And it does actually, by default, bring up websites which it designates as relevant to your geographic zone, higher ranked than others. And I've known that for years. But what I didn't know is that it is now going to basically be looking at your entire profile, the videos that you watch on YouTube, the stuff you're writing in your emails, and any other, I guess, parts of the Google empire that it can extract information from, to decide how to return search results to you when you do a Google search.
That's right. And not only that, so they use not only your personal profile, but if you're on Google Plus and all these sort of social networks and Twitter, they can also, not so much Twitter, but they can vaguely do it. But and it's all very secret, so no one actually knows what's going on. But because, you know, it's intellectual property that I don't want other search engines to copy, and so they'll deliver ads. Say your friends on Google Plus start putting up videos on certain bike brands, and you start searching for bikes, they might say, "Hey, your friends also suggested these." So it collects your what they call your social graph. Now, in terms of being worried about all of this, I think if you want to opt out, stop using Google products, and it's quite easy to do, really. I mean, all of these people say, "Oh no, it's too easy, too hard. I'm too far lodged in there." Well, look, it depends on your worry scale. If you're worried enough, there is alternatives to every single Google product, and a lot of them are free. Some of them you have to pay for, but if you're worried enough, you'll then pay for them. And so it's really important. What really worries me is that in the past, if the FBI or CIA wanted to get information, get a warrant and seek your profile, your Gmail profile, they'd have to go through all this stuff, then go to Google and say, "Hey, we want it. We want the profile of this user." And Google would say, "Well, you've only got one subpoena here, or whatever they call it, which do you want the Gmail or the YouTube? And they couldn't get everything. You see, they would have to spend a lot more time saying, well, we want one for Google, we want for Google Web Search, we want one for Gmail, we want one for Google Docs, we want one for YouTube. Now, if the government says, hey, we want Josh's web history or profile, that they can get the whole lot in one foul swoop. And this is what scares me. Although, historically, Google have been a lot better than Yahoo, Microsoft, and the MSM, because they have just passed over information willy-nilly very quickly and just gone, yep, whatever. And Google have historically had a record of saying, hey, no, well, we need proper proof that we want to deliver this. And this is because you start to deliver stuff, people start.
Okay, sorry, I'm just losing you a bit there, Josh. Now, we are going to break shortly, and we'll be back for another segment of the show to discuss this in more depth. Welcome back to Truth News. We are talking about privacy and Google. And I want to now give you my opinion on this, Josh, because, see, I actually see this question as related to the problems of monopoly capitalism and crony capitalism, which we were actually talking about in the previous show. Mm-hmm. And to me, this is a classic example of why monopoly capitalism is a real danger. And it's not just about fair trading practices. It's a real threat to democracy. Because as businesses get more and bigger and more powerful, they start to their infrastructure becomes so predominant that it is hard to even differentiate it from government infrastructure. And in fact, governments tend to rely on the large corporate infrastructures because they provide the infrastructure that the government actually needs to operate. And this is, of course, happens across the board with technology and has happened with basic resources such as electricity, gas, etc. And, of course, oil. I mean, let's just think about oil being the predominant fuel that is needed to basically keep the entire world civilization running. So it's hardly surprising then, is it, that oil companies have been effectively able to control governments over the years, and that their agendas somehow get merged in with the agendas of the military-industrial complex.
Banking, you know, as a commodity.
Well, again, banking, of course, is another one, and you know, I don't want to go too far down that path. But the point here is that what we have with Google is that it was a company that launched itself with a search engine, and then it became very successful, and it started acquiring new products, building new products. It launched Gmail, I think, around about 10, 12 years ago. It, of course, acquired YouTube in 2006, Google Maps, which was one of its own initiatives, which was brilliant. And all of these things have actually made it more and more powerful, and it has really been important and done a lot of good things. I agree. But I want to make some points about privacy. Now, I don't use Gmail, and one of the reasons I don't use Gmail is I never agreed to the idea of this company reading my emails. Now, of course, they argue that it's only an automatic process. It's like a robot that's reading your emails in order to then serve up ads that might be relevant to your content. To me, I don't care whether it's a robot or a human, and I don't even accept the distinction, to be honest with you. I think it's a bogus distinction. If a robot is reading my emails, more than likely a human has access to them as well, because robots are programmed by human beings.
Well, but the thing is, the robots that are reading your email, there's a lot of reasons to have spiders and things crawling. When I say spiders, for all those folks that don't know, these little programs that crawl your email, there's not only reasons to serve ads, but there's other reasons. For instance, search. But to search your emails, you need to have the computer going through and indexing every email. That's a robot looking through all your email.
Right.
And indexing and storing. So when you do when you want to do a search, you want that capability of a robot. Now, what you're saying, though, is that you're saying, I don't want a third party. I don't want to give a third party the right to store all my information. And that's totally acceptable and fine.
Well,
and I think it's a good thing to say, hey, I'm not going to use it then.
Well, hang on. I want to make a point that I make a clear distinction between public and private. I consider, for example, the conversation what we're having right now is public. This is a public discussion.
Yeah.
This is going on the internet. I consider any post on a blog or a forum or on Facebook to be essentially public. Now, there are degrees of sharing that are done in an environment like Facebook, but from my point of view, the World Wide Web is a public environment. And I am actually not concerned about people writing robots that go through and scoop up all that information. Just like the Google van did driving around taking photographs in the street, I'm not concerned about that either. See, I think that the focus of the privacy debate has been confused, and I think there's a lack of focus of what is really to be deemed private and what is really to be deemed
public. So you're saying that a private email between me and you should be considered totally private.
Well, privacy is important in life. We have to have the ability to have private channels of communication.
Absolutely.
And so if
I meet up with you on the street,
yes,
and have a conversation, no one should be allowed to have a copy of that conversation.
Well,
if we don't know about it.
Indeed, and of course, we don't like to use these words, and I know you don't either, about what should be allowed and what shouldn't. But what I emphasize is that there is a distinction between private and public, and everyone knows what it is. Like in common practice, everyone understands it. So if I'm having a quiet chat with you in a public environment, but it's just you and me having a chat, that is actually a private conversation. So if someone's eavesdropping on it, that is invading privacy. And of course, this does occur. And to a certain extent, we put up with it. But we call it up for what it is. It's spying, it's eavesdropping, okay? And and it can have degrees, and it can be used in ways which are quite nefarious and quite, dangerous. And there needs to be a recognition that when a large organization, which has this massive infrastructure and massive reach, is doing it, I think that the people who are essentially the customers of that organization need to stand up and say, no, we won't do this. But of course, as we've seen, as organizations get bigger and bigger, people find it harder and harder to stand up against them. And you were saying before it's quite easy for people to use a different service. I disagree. I don't think it's easy at all. I think it's extremely hard. And it's the same with any type of monopoly situation. When a major supermarket chain moves into a small town, typically they put all of the other businesses out of business, and they essentially make it all but impossible for people not to shop at the big new Walmart or whatever it might be. and they're able to do this because of their economic power, having this ability to restructure everything to support their needs.
Yeah, but at the same time, huge corporations are like the Titanic. They're massive. They have problems as well because they can't turn quick enough. They're not nimble. Whereas small businesses can come in, tuck, tuck, tuck. They can find a new niche, a new market. Plus, you know, the thing about voluntarism and dealing with markets is that you can't keep messing with your clients. If Google do something absolutely horrendous, if they start just giving all the details out to governments left, right, and center, and where governments just start arresting people, I can tell you, people will start leaving their products. And you know, the only thing that really scares me is if they then start thinking, just like some car companies did or have done in the past or are still doing, where they put a price on how many accidents happen per year. They say, oh, well, you know, if 200 people die a year of this, if we don't put this $15 little part, this plastic little widget in the fuel tank, then we'll have 200 people die a year. But that's worth it because we put a value of this much money on each person and da 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 da. So and it that could be the same with Google if they start saying, well, if we lose you know, this many people due to them being scared of privacy policy, well, we put a price on each of those heads, and well, that's okay because we've still got this many people that will use us. I don't think they will do that. I think I think Google want the maximum reach, and if they start seeing people going elsewhere, they will change. And this is important because Google isn't a monopoly. It really isn't. It's very large, and it does everything for free, which is very hard to compete against. I agree.
Well, we'll have to have an argument about that on another show, because I do think Google is a monopoly. However, I want to point out one thing, is that this argument about convenience, which is very attractive, and I want to explain why the argument about convenience is a very dangerous one. It is very convenient to say, well, let's let Google have access to all my information, including my private emails, so it can provide a better service for me. And yes, it may indeed do that. It may actually provide very good context search for you because it's stored all this information. But its ability then to have all this information, which is very private information about you, your private communications with people, of course, If that gets into the hands of the wrong people and gets into the hands of a tyrannical government, this could be extremely dangerous. And let's compare that with, say, the arguments for RFID chips. Because indeed, it would be very convenient if we all had an RFID chip in our wrist that we wouldn't even need keys anymore. We could just wave our hand. We wouldn't have to, you know, fumble for the keys at night. We could just walk through the supermarket, just buy things, just wave our hand, and just, you know, the magic RFID chip would take care of everything and automatically deduct things from the account. So convenient, isn't it? This is the problem with the convenience argument.
Yeah, but
because I mean, obviously, this can be used to control behavior just as much as it can be used to add convenience.
Absolutely, and convenience is, you know, the road to tyranny is paved with convenience. That's for sure. But at the same time, I tend to look at it like this. What really scares me is guns and jails and prisons and torture. Now, Google doesn't have any of those. Who does have them? Governments. Governments have those. And they're the ones that we need to worry about having monopolies on our information.
Correct. We are going to have to wind it up at this point, Josh. I'd want to continue this discussion. It's a big one.
Just quickly say, look, yeah. I'm going to post a whole heap of alternatives to any Google product on the show notes. Just go to truthnews.com.au. I'll prove that it's not a monopoly, that you're definitely free to choose.
Terrific. Okay, thanks a lot, Josh. See you next time.
Okay.
Yeah. If you would like to support Truth News Australia, here's something you can do right now. Go to our Facebook page, and you can find that by going to the website and then clicking on the Facebook link. If you're not already a fan of our Facebook page, click on the like button. Then invite all your friends to become fans, and you can do that by clicking on the link on the right-hand side that says Invite Friends.